The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guests today on Getting the Yes And are Frances Collier and Angela V. Shelton, who are collectively known as Frangela, a Los Angeles-based comedy duo with roots at Second City Stages in Chicago and Detroit. They have hosted their own radio show, The Week According to Frangela. They've been on tour as part of Stephanie Miller's Sexy Liberal Resistance Tour, which is coming to Chicago on October 14th at the Athenaeum Theater, so get your tickets. They also have their podcast, The Final Word, which you can find at Apple Podcasts. You may have seen Frances on television shows such as Curb Your Enthusiasm or The Cleveland Show. She's also had a recurring role on Disney's Hannah Montana as Hannah's bodyguard, Roxy. Angela has been seen on Mr. Show and Grounded for Life, and you likely heard her voice in the hit film Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Frances and Angela, welcome to the show.
Hi! Thank you. Let me throw in there that I did Toronto Second City also.
I think you were the only, if I recall this correctly, person to have done the main stage in Detroit, Toronto, and Chicago.
Both stages in Chicago, too. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Both stages in Chicago. That's a record. All right. I'm going to start this conversation by telling you both the earliest memory I have of each of you. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Frances, you were in some sort of teen troupe at the Second City, I believe in the late 80s or early 90s. You were tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You were tiny, fearless, and you had a ton of hair. You were also incredibly kind and supportive of everyone around you. Don't respond to that because now I'm going to go to Angela, which is different. We met in the mid to late 1990s when you auditioned for the inaugural cast of the Second City Detroit. And I remember you as loud, fearless, and perfectly comfortable making wholly inappropriate comments to me. Is that accurate?
I think probably.
That's pretty accurate.
Yeah.
I think so.
And
I think so.
It sounds to me like the recipe for what is a rare thing these days, which is a comedy duo.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I have a lot to thank Second City for, but literally, Second City gave me both my better halves.
Yeah, your husband and your comedy partner.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's
and
right.
And my best friend.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I got two best friends out of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So
don't even lie. He's a good friend, your husband. Like, you're close.
He is. But I'm looking to recast at the earliest opportunity.
He's not listening to this. It's fine.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, you got to keep your options open.
So I'm curious.
Yeah.
I'm curious with you two, though, because I don't think we've ever talked about this. I mean, and I don't know if you know this, like Andrew Alexander, who is the owner of Second City and was like my boss and their boss. I mean, he was all our bosses. He has always wanted to revive the idea of a comedy duo. He did that with a couple folks, with Bob Martin in Toronto. Remember that? And he's always felt like, oh, this is something that's missing and could never get it right. But you actually did it. And I find it hard to think of another example out there other than, you know, the Mr. Show guys who did it for a little while.
Right.
And Key and Peele.
Key and Peele, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is that duos are marriages,
mm-hmm.
You know? They really are. And you do have to find that person that you literally want to talk about every single thing on this earth about,
right.
With.
Yep. And that's why those mostly break up, but you guys haven't.
Right.
No, yeah, because we are, in fact, best friends. So it's not just, you know, a business relationship. In fact, that's not nearly as important to us, you know, as our personal relationship. And we're in each other's families. So that's, it's, you know, I think when you, because we've all known people who work together in maybe a different way. Like when we were there, like Tom Janis and Anna McKay were very much like a team, you know, a writing team and other people. And it's just that we've, our friendship maintains. And so we still talk to each other all day, every day. So it just is, it just works because of that. I don't know how everybody else has done it over the years, but for us, that is how it is. It's our friendship.
I'd also suggest what you guys do is a little bit different than some of those other duos, because you riff like jazz musicians. Like, you seem to jump on each other's stuff, and you're not afraid to talk when the other is talking, and it makes some sense that way. And you do feel like it's incredible improvisation, but grounded in this immense knowing of each other, which is a unique thing. That's not what Key and Peele necessarily do. They craft out their things differently. So that, that it is. It's like jazz.
Exactly like that. And sometimes,
that's
you know,
kind.
Like in hip hop, what'd you say, Angela?
I said that's kind. Thank you. That was very sweet.
Because I said you're like jazz. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in, like in hip hop, too, sometimes we're each other's hype man. You know, somebody takes a verse, and then the other person throws and sprinkles in, you know, commentary along and around that. So, you're right, to catch the musicality of a conversation.
Yeah.
We also still surprise each other.
Hmm.
You know, like, one of us will say something the other one is totally not expecting, and it's hysterical, because we are trying to make each other laugh first.
Yeah, yeah. And it comes across very naturally. So we have – there's so much stuff that we can talk about. One of the reasons – one of the great reasons I wanted to talk to you guys is we are living at a unique time in the world and in comedy. And it's
you mean
one of the,
hell.
Yeah, well, one could describe it as hell, sure. I mean, it is one of those things that, you know, if you spend too long in a meeting, you come out and go, like, what happened? And you're not surprised when, you know, it could be the destruction of the earth, or it could be the most hilarious, terrible thing you've heard. But I'm curious, and here's what I want to do. Before we get into, like, comedy in the Trump era, I want us to think back to when we were all working together at Second City in the 90s and early 2000s, and like what it meant to be doing sort of political satire at that time. Like when you started to and I know this from both of you because you're both very passionate about politics and the world we live in and social justice. And that's something that Second City should be, you know, a part of, but wasn't always. And I think you guys were there at a time to help fuel that in a very positive way. What was going through your mind then as a prelude to what's going on now?
Do you want to start, Angela?
Yeah, I can start. I think at that time, Second City, I remember really being thrown by, because, you know, I did start Second City in Detroit, which is no longer there, and then went to Toronto and stuff, but really feeling like that this organization that meant so much to me, you know, growing up in Detroit, I watched SCTV, and, you know, I really, that meant really had a problem with integration, you know, and so, and not just like having minorities, but having minorities, like it's such an interesting thing to read about why it is that you can hire ethnic minorities, you can hire, you know, more women, but can you keep them, you know, because of the environment. And that was something, I think that was always on my mind there, that especially because we started in Detroit and that was like the, you know, the most diverse cast.
Yeah.
To now hear about these casts that are so much more, you know, broadly, you know, touching on so many more levels. I mean, it took a long time for there to be an out gay person on stage. It took a long time for there to be, you know, so that was the integration of that and being there and what that meant and feeling like I had this responsibility as a member of that cast to address that and to address those issues. That was on my mind most of the time during that time.
Right. And then Franny, I mean, like, again, this is something that you, as part of this sort of young wave at Second City, were, and I think there was like zero representation when you first started there.
Well, you know what? We had, I can name you the four black people. It was Judith Scott.
Yeah.
It was Tim Meadows,
mm-hmm.
Meg Holloman, and Hildreth.
John Hildreth.
John Hildreth.
And, you know, and they were sprinkled for a while, you know, here and there. And I don't think Holloman had always just been in the touring company. But the thing is that, you know, when I was 22, Andrew had me start the outreach program at Second City.
Yeah.
Remember that in that horrible closet where everybody went to the bathroom?
Yes.
And they would have to step over me to go to the bathroom. I listened to people go to for 8 hours a day, Kelly.
Don't you say that man wasn't about diversity. Don't say it.
That actually ended up becoming Lois Kaz's office, by the way. Inside reference.
Here's the thing. I think for being Canadian, I think it bothered Andrew. The lack of diversity bothered him in like 91.
Right. No. And gender equity. Gender equity was an issue for him. Because the cast in Canada were always gender equal and they weren't in Chicago.
And so, you know, watching things, you know, and before you became a producer there, because I can tell you my first memory of you is sitting, you hosting in the main stage.
Uh-oh.
You know, you were a host.
Yeah. Can we leave it there?
I remember. Yes. But here's the thing. The reality is that, you know, we come around, and now, at that time, you know, going and reaching out to people, we found a lot of people, you know, I think we introduced a lot of people to improv, people of color and women. And from that we got Sal Pacone, we got Gayco, we got a whole bunch of different things.
Star Friday Night.
Friday Night. You know, East meets West.
Yeah.
All these different groups started people who never thought that they would improvise. Owen Smith, who writes for Survivor's Remorse right now, you know, is one of the people who we brought into those spaces, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much what I've learned in retrospect, where people, how they came through the organization. It's that this work and that organization touched them at some point, and now that a lot of people are doing so many different things that they didn't think that they would ever be doing.
Yeah.
And I think there was a, you know, certainly among us, and I think because we were all sort of closer in age then too, because I was a much younger person. But you know, it was this idea that we could also learn and push each other. So, and that Absolutely. Was my point with you, Ange, which is like, you know, I think one of the reasons you felt comfortable sort of saying anything is because it was like it was a safe place to do that, and it was a good way to make me do something.
And you told me to. I mean, I remember when we were auditioning Ann Libra, you may know her. I don't know if you do.
I remember her.
Do you remember her? Yeah.
White woman, right? White woman.
Yeah, really, really smart, really cute.
Yeah.
Makes a mean Mai Tai. But she, you know, we had that audition process that took a really long time.
Yeah.
And I remember I was reading the paper, and as I do, muttering and mumbling and screaming. And she was like, you know what? We're going to have a segment called Angela Reads the Paper. because she's like, it's really, and I curse a lot, you know, too. So I remember thinking, this is the place. And even, dare I conjure him up, John Holtzman. Craziest stage manager, I think, I may be wrong, but I think maybe the craziest stage manager of all Second City history.
I will second that.
Yeah, and when we were given over to him for a year of rehearsals to write a show, at one point, one of his many evaluations into the wee hours, he told me, which by the way, he did in his house, with you sitting in a dark room, him smoking with a projector projecting something you couldn't see onto your face.
No.
And then when you got up to leave, you could see it was something from, like, it looked like it was Schindler's List. But he was, like, projecting onto your face. And it was crazy. He was nuts. Yeah. So, but he gave me the greatest note ever, which he's like, every, you know, 6 nights a week, you're the most powerful person here. You know, like, get on, what are you going to say?
Yeah.
You get to go on that stage and say whatever you want. What's it going to be? And I was like, is it going to be, I'm wearing a funny outfit, which I love that humor just as much as a lot of other people. But I was like, no, I have things to say. But then when I went to Canada, the joke couldn't be me being black because they have a very different social setup there.
Right.
Like the racism, it's not that they don't have issues, but it's just, you know, Second City, Chicago, Detroit, I could just walk out onto stage and that might be the blow to a scene. That might be the, oh, it's a black person, you know, but there they didn't, operate that way. So I think both those things help. But yes, absolutely, Second City gave me, from the moment I started even auditioning, permission to say whatever I wanted.
Okay, so let's make this leap. We're all gearing up for this election. We're all pretty sure how it's going to go. It doesn't go that way. I don't know where you guys were, but I had done a corporate like keynote the night before in San Francisco. Obviously couldn't sleep all night watching the returns come in, and around 4:30 or 5 a.m. that when the Starbucks opened across the street from my hotel, I went in to a bunch of crying baristas who I had to console and talk to them. I talked to them about how Reagan had been elected my freshman year going to college, and we all thought there'd be nuclear war, and we got through it. And I'm not believing anything I'm saying. I'm just trying to console these baristas.
Right. Get your latte and get out.
And get my latte and get out. And then, But now you have to do comedy in an environment that, quite frankly, no one has ever experienced. I mean, what?
We literally have people come up to us during the Sexy Liberal shows and say, "You're saving my life. You're literally saving me."
Dude, get this. You're doing the Lord's work.
Right.
Like, we hear that all the time. And she's a Buddhist and I'm an atheist. And we're both like, I just, as a comedian, never thought there'd be people holding me in tears saying, "You saved my life. You're doing the Lord's work. We need you. Please stay." Like, I'm like, we're telling jokes. Like, it's amazing to me how it's not just, you know, we've all talked about pointing out the hypocrisies in society and what we feel social and political satire's role is and Second City's role, you know, what we think we should be doing out here. But to have people react so emotionally to us, and I mean, they're laughing, but they're crying and they're grateful. It's a lot. Like, there are times when I'm like, I don't know how to respond to that because it just seems insane that that's where we're like on a healing mission in the weirdest way.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how to.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Being brought up, you don't believe fat meat is greasy is one of the things we say all the time. Mm. But growing up at Second City, Martin Mott, people who taught me the work, you know, Sheldon, everybody, you know, the roots of Second City, and I bring this up in so many conversations I have in general, the roots of Second City is social political movement.
Yeah.
And you don't, in the 90s, going back to what you asked us, in the 90s, we talked about, you know, political correctness, that somebody came out and did a rape scene, you know what I'm saying? But
they had gotten into that area of, like, funny restaurant scenes. You know what I mean? Like, there was a couple years before. Yeah.
You know, the fantastic, you know, Fran Christmas gift.
Humidifier.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you had those relationship scenes. But here's the thing. I didn't know that I was being prepared to what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
I was told that's what I was learning. But I didn't know how I would be able to use it. And the fact is that we are in the middle of a social political movement.
Yep.
And to be voices of that right now, satirical voices that are able to get in there. You know, when we are on the radio, on Stephanie Miller's show, we said in all last week, had a conservative man call in crying. About just coming to the realization about that there is climate change because he'd been down in the island.
St. Martin. Yeah, he'd been St. Martin.
No.
And he's talking about all those people. He started crying. It's like, here they are. They have nothing. These people have nothing, and they're probably about to lose it all and maybe their lives, and their number one concern was getting all of us off the island.
Right.
Yeah, and then he started to cry, and he went, "We left them there. We left them there." And I was like, "You know, we were like, you didn't leave. That's their home. They needed to be there. They wanted." He's like, "I have to go home, and I have to talk to all of my family and friends, and I have to make this clear to them that we have to stop fighting this." It was
powerful.
And next up, funny, haha.
Right.
You know, right. It's like you don't. But it is this ebb and flow of like when we do shows of this like. Because not everything is funny, you know. Like some stuff, you bring the passion and you bring the real talk to it, but it's not a joke.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that because this is a really topic area that I'm fascinated by, and I have strong opinions around political correctness around what's okay to say and not to say, and around comedy. And I'll give you my short thesis, and I want to throw it to you, which is one of the problems we get into this conversation, and I'm flashing back to a few years ago when we heard that Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld wouldn't play college campuses.
Right.
You know, there's that stuff. And then other people, you know, all this conversation around there. And for my mind, the thing, there's nuance that people are missing on both sides. And the one thing is that comedy's job is to cross a line. And as Carlin says, comedy's job is to cross a line, take your hand, have you come with me, and make you glad you came, in that side. But the other side is that comedy changes, and what is okay changes. And so don't use your free speech to get away with your hack job.
Thank you.
Thank
you, Kelly. Thank you. Thank you. You are preaching what our gospel. If there's one thing we hate, it's comedians who get off stage and blame the audience.
Right.
You know, they're like, this audience sucks. These kids don't know what's funny. Actually, they do. You just didn't do it.
Yeah.
Like, we go to colleges, as you know, all the time, and we've never had a problem. And we don't get up there and tell, you know, just talk about, oh, my God, I ate this ice cream. Why do I feel fat? You know, we're doing social political humor.
Yeah.
The fact is, maybe they just aren't funny or weren't in that situation. Maybe they're at a point where they no longer, you know, we're pop culture fiends, Francis and I. So we, like, they're just not connecting with that age group and trying to blame it on these, on those young people who are adults, by the way. I wish people would stop calling them kids.
Yeah.
And act like somehow they're not getting it. And I'm like, no, actually, you're just not, you're not changing your act. You're not, you know, reflecting their references or the things that matter to them or their reality at all.
Well, what's interesting, what you guys would find fascinating, because everyone leaves Second City, right? But I stay and other people stay. So what happens is we have certain scenes from the archives that we do on the college campus, and suddenly they go, no, no, no. So we can't, we can't do Gump anymore because we use we use the term retarded.
Right.
As a joke, and it's not a joke anymore, and I get that. I actually do that. The other scene we can't do is Two Truths and a Lie.
Wow.
Okay.
Because the blow of the scene, the joke of the scene is that
that's mine. Yeah.
It
was actually mine.
And the punchline is that it's the woman's a man. And you know, especially in the last couple of years.
You know what? I totally didn't even remember that.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
I don't remember. Oh, this is, it kills me when people come here who just got out of tour core or whatever, and they're like, "Oh, I did your scene," and I'm like, "What scene was that?" Like, I don't remember it. Because you know, I did a lot of. I mean, I did all those stages. I did a lot of shows.
I know, and that's but that particular scene. That's a classic Second City scene. It was a staple of the touring company forever, and it's a great scene. And it was not. There was nothing wrong with that punchline when we did it, in the sense that the common culture was sort of like, no, that's cool, and you're at least you're bringing up something that people maybe don't talk about or whatever. But then, but then it changes, and this is the thing that I think is important to talk about, the sort of older comedians who complain about the audiences, which is, no, your act should evolve and change.
Thank you.
And that's okay, and it does. You don't have to apologize for the material that you did 10 years ago. No one's asking you to do that.
Right. Well, here's the thing we say, too. I have two things on that. Number one, there's a difference between, like, I know people were getting on Amy Schumer's case for some joke that they thought were anti-Semitic that she said she used to do and no longer does. And I remember her statement being something along the lines of, those are the kind of jokes you have to do when you're just starting out, and I don't do them anymore. And I was like, that's weird, because Francis and I didn't have to do them.
Never once.
Mm-hmm. Never once. I mean, because when people are like, well, if everybody looked at everything you said, what would they find? I go, not that.
Right.
No.
Yes, they will find me using a term like retarded 10 years ago, you know, however many years ago. That you might find.
Yep.
But you're not going to find me being anti-Semitic. You're not going to find me being, you know, misogynist or anti-trans or any of those things. And so I'm like, so that isn't true. Number one, you don't have to say those things. And number two, I feel like people don't take responsibility for, there's a difference between free speech. Free speech means the government can't stop you from saying things.
Right.
A college campus getting together and saying, we don't want to hear from you, is called taste and discernment. That is because, you know what, friends, we don't bitch about not getting invited to, what's that religious school? The Bob Jones, what's his name?
Like Oral Roberts University.
Right,
or
exactly. We're not. we're not on CNN talking about Oral Roberts University doesn't bring us there. They don't want to hear from us, and that's their choice. And if we did get invited there and then people wanted to protest, that would be their choice. That's the exercise of free speech.
That's
the way that we exercise. I mean, I'm so sick of this argument being put in this area that it doesn't belong. Nobody is denying these people free speech. They're saying we, as an audience member, and also these people are dangerous, like Milos, you know, Danger Man, like they're saying, I don't want to hear from you and I don't want you in my community. And they have the right to do that. That is free speech.
Yeah, I think this is another case where the problem is in when we abandon nuance. Because, yeah, Milo, I don't, and Richard Spencer, I don't even know why you're arguing for them. You know, but if it's a conservative columnist, if it's David Brooks, or if it's, you know, I don't know, Bill Kristol, or even like Sean Hannity, who's a, you know, whatever.
Right.
I mean, like, to me, that's not worth the debate. I'm actually curious. Yeah. I'm curious about this with you guys. Like, because you definitely play to your audience. You are booked in that. Have you played to not your audience in any sort of recent memory?
Yes.
All right, tell me about
once, once when we weren't told. Remember the woman who told us the audience was going to be younger and they were all octogenarians?
Oh no.
That was a really hard one because we came out to do, we did a single ladies bit and then we looked at the audience and there were quite literally people with nurses and oxygen tanks. I'm not talking about just they weren't young. And then we looked backstage and all of them, they were having a great time. And I realized, oh, what they did is they got the show that they wanted. The people running the show, not the people. It was like it was a charity. It was a benefit. And so all the rich older people were like, huh? Like, it was just nuts. But mostly it was a reference level issue, I would say, that they just, we didn't expect them to be that age group.
Right.
But can you think of another, Francis?
Well, you know what? In general, like, you know, when people come across us, say, on the radio or in a situation, and they weren't expecting us or expecting to like us. Well, here's the thing, what we say all the time. There is a thing called the Frangela train. Yeah. Either you can get on it or get run over by it. But that, those are your only two choices. Jump on and you're going to laugh and have a great time, or we will run past you.
Yeah, you're not going to ruin our good time. Also, I think the hard part here is that people pay to come to these shows. So generally people don't pay to come to shows to see things they don't like.
Yeah.
You know, like if it's free, that's a whole different thing, you know, but like, and I also think that we're progressive left, you know, liberals, and that we tend to not be a group that goes around protesting other people performing that we don't like. That's just not kind of how we organize generally,
right.
In terms of comedy or artists, especially in terms of like, you know, white supremacists, absolutely. We organize against them, but yeah, it's not, that isn't it. So we don't necessarily have that kind of experience, but like we've had one of my favorite calls ever when we were on a radio show. This guy called and he identified himself as white. And he said, you know, I heard you talking and I realized you were two black women. And I almost turned the channel because I was like, eh, they got nothing to say to me.
Yeah.
But then I listened for a minute, and I'm glad I did. I like you. You do have things to say to me. And we were quiet for a second, and then we both went, you know what? We're going to take the compliment. Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah. Good job. I'm going to take that compliment.
Good.
I'm going to take that compliment.
So I had an experience. This was not that long ago. So one of the things I have been trying to do in the last year or so is consume more media that is as center as possible. Because it's, like you guys, I'm left of Chairman Mao. But I don't want to be in my bubble, and I know I'm in my bubble. So two things I do is I go to Real Clear Politics, and that's a great website for a lot of the different ideas. But then I listen to POTUS on my Sirius channel. And I'm driving home, and I believe it's in the Steele and Unger slot, and Michael Steele is a Republican. You know where I'm going with this. Seth Unger's a Democrat. There's some live event, and I hear you two idiots like, and you are like just being incredibly vulgar, and I think you were doing like a pro Trump thing. Like everyone on stage decided to be very pro Trump, and it was so funny. But I'm just like, where did this come from out of my radio? It's suddenly like the most bizarre thing I've ever heard. And
I am always amazed by the weird connections you make. So that was Politicon.
Okay. Oh yeah, Politicon. Sure.
That was Politicon, and we were doing, they call it the devil's advocate, right, Francis?
Yep.
Yeah.
So what they do is they get a bunch of liberal, I think, generally comedic people and a bunch of conservative comedic people, and they make us argue the other side.
Oh, that's great.
So we had to argue the pro-Trump, which was hard. Yeah. I mean, you were hearing it, but we kept holding up signs that said, help us.
Yeah.
We'll pay you if you can get us out of here. Yeah, that was why that happened. And they told us we could swear, but then afterwards we're like, well, we didn't really mean like that. Like, well, you said we could.
Oh, yeah, no, it was shocking to me.
Yeah. Stephanie Miller was with us, and she's out of control, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, I loved it. It was great.
What's great is then you spend the night drinking with Michael Steele and find out that he loves house music.
Oh, hilarious.
He was studying to be a priest.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in the seminary.
Right. You know, like, we have these weird, like, we'll meet people, and it's like, yeah, we're hanging. Michael Steele, he came to our show, and Rick Unger is a wonderful man and friend of ours now, and you're just like, how does that stuff happen? Like, how do you end up? And we did tell him the truth. We're like, Michael Steele, we kind of have called you some names in the past, but now we would give anything for you to be president.
W at this point is like,
oh,
you know,
God,
what?
I love him.
Sweet man. A sweet, sweet man.
Sweetest, misunderstood, kindest, gentlest heart.
Yeah. Oh,
he's
Romney.
Like,
how about the dreamboat? That would be Mitt Romney.
Oh, my God.
Mitt Romney.
Oh,
you know what? I would respect his religious choices. Oh, you couldn't say a bad word about Mitt Romney around me if he was president right now. I'd be like, hush your mouth. That is my Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I think about how many things, I'm not even kidding. I've had moments where I was like, Palin's not that bad. She's, you know, she's crazy and stupid, but she wouldn't be this out the box. But I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
That's how bad it is.
Well, and perhaps the silver lining here is that we have needed to be shown the extremes that we could go to, in fact, to find the middle again.
Yes. But did it have to be this hard? Did it have to be this hard?
I don't know. In some ways, maybe. And it's funny because I just sent my son Nick off to his sophomore year of college. I'll give you a moment.
Wow.
I know. I remember before he was born.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I know.
Oh,
my
Lord.
God. I was upset earlier because I was looking at my grocery store receipt, and it says on there, bypass age to buy liquor. Like, she just bypassed it.
Right.
And I was like, I actually was hurt about that, and now that pain is deeper.
I know. I'm sorry. But, I mean, but this is the thing.
It's true, though. I can't believe it.
And what he is, I mean, he's at Skidmore, and it's a very woke campus, extremely woke.
Yes.
To the point that he's got his queer lit class, and he's like, hey, look at my books. These are the gayest books you're ever going to see. And I'm like, oh, yeah, queer lit in your directing class. It is not yet – that is as gay as it gets in terms of your lineup. But what he is doing in many ways is sort of teaching me another middle or a new middle because, you know, I'm 51. I'm outdated on some of this stuff and not always eager to learn and being like, hey, I know what's what, but we all need a sort of a reset. And so,
absolutely.
And my hope is, and I think it's true, is one of the reasons comedy is so popular right now. And you've got, I'm very excited for Jordan Klepper's show coming on, The Opposition, is because what our work, I think, does is shine a light that, you know, Anne says this. Anne's big line now is that comedy doesn't change the world, but comedy shows you the world has changed. So
exactly.
Oh, that's beautiful.
If we can do that collectively, right, across all our audiences, all that, and then it gives us a chance to actually talk to each other where then the mixed audiences can get back together.
Exactly. No, we say it all the time, yeah.
We say, you know, comedy is the way in. You know, if I can just get in with a laugh, I can introduce you. We see some radical things on stage.
Yep.
And but people, if I can get you laughing about it, you will at least consider it.
Yep. All right, you guys. So we've already gone over what my normal time is on the show, and what we always end the show with is we ask our guests to tell a yes and story. which is kind of a softball for each of you. But the idea is, you know, is there a time in your life, and again, like, I know who I'm talking to, when you would have said no, but instead you said yes, and I'm wondering, I know what that means professionally for you, but I wonder if personally each of you have a thought that comes to your mind when you're like, oh, how have I applied, you know, had the application of yes, and, which I know, and I've learned at Second City and in all my improv classes, how have I applied that to my life?
Yes.
Ange?
Francis?
Okay,
mine is kind of for you, though, so I don't know if that works.
What, for me or like for Francis?
For Francis.
Do it.
We do this a lot. We answer questions for each other. It's really, it annoyed the hell out of, it annoys people, but we, so I, what I think of is when I think of when you were at Second City as a producer, and I was trying to talk you into quitting, not, you know, not the improv or Second City, to quit Second City because I wanted us to be a full-time acting team. And it was a really, because, you know, it's, you know, it is, I don't know why I thought it was a good idea, to be honest, but
it's a terrible idea. It was the worst idea.
It really was. It was like a really, but like, I remember really wanting you and being like, literally looking at you and being like, just yes, man, just jump. Let's just do it. What's the worst that can happen? They can't take anything from us except, you know, like food and housing. But other than that, we will be fine. And like, and you did it. She did it.
I did.
And it was really.
I did.
And I remember years later, not years later. I don't make it sound like it didn't. You didn't feel good about it right away, because I think you did. But I do remember years later, we did up this pilot, and you turned to me and you said, you looked at me and you said, I'm gonna try not to cry. That you were like, I would never have had this experience if it hadn't been for you.
Mm.
You know, of doing this pilot, Francis and Angela, and she's like, this is something I would never have even tried for. And it just, that to me, that's the first thing I think of.
That's great. Franny?
She just gave my answer. I'll give one for you when you have said yes, Anne. Let's see. I'm trying to think, Angela. You got one.
One that's clean
for you.
One that's clean. I would say, you know what? Going to Toronto was really, like, that was a big deal for me. And
yeah.
I didn't know how that was going to be.
Yeah.
And then coming back and going to Chicago, that was, as you know, that was hard. And I think leaving Second City, you know, like when you leave, you really are, I mean, I spent my entire adult life, really, you know, my all of my 20s, you know, like my, that's really the only job I had out of college, you know? And so that was hard when I was like, I'm walking out of here. And not only am I walking out of here when I left Chicago, I'm going to LA, and we had a cartoon we were doing then.
Yeah.
You know, Hey Moni. But that was it. And first, you know, I just was like, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. You always have this community on some level. Like, I knew coming to L.A. that, like, there are all these people here, right? You're not, like, alone. And, like, Andrew, you know, set up meetings with agents. You know, people don't, you have a community. It's not as hard as, like, you get on a bus with a ticket and a dream. But it is still hard, and it doesn't mean you're going to get anywhere. So, yeah, I think that for me, just going to that first audition was a big yes, and. Nobody, I mean, it was crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that cattle call, 800 people, like,
yeah, including,
I'll never forget it.
And this is in Detroit. We had this open cattle call, and there's, like, rent-a-nerds showed up, and, like, people, like, dressed like Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, it was crazy town. And people from all everywhere. Like, there were people, like, actually Colin
Ferguson
from Canada. He was, you know, he came down from, was he in Toronto? Did he live in Toronto? I forget where he lived.
Montreal kid.
He came down to that audition to get into Second. Like, that was really incredible. When I think back to, doesn't it blow your mind when you're like, somebody asks you, like, oh, you know that person? I'm like, only for like 25 years.
Right. I mean, Colin, you know, so people know Colin was the star of the show Eureka, and he's now the Maytag. Mm-hmm. He's the Maytag man now, right?
He is, yes.
Yeah, he's the Maytag man. And that boy, I will bet you he still takes his shirt off in public as often as humanly possible.
Oh, you know he did with his little, but let me tell you something. However you may see that as arrogant, it is a worth the viewing. He keeps it tight. All he eats are Tangelo.
Oh, yeah. No. He is.
That's
he
all
is
I've ever seen him eat.
A very good-looking man with a, yes, that's true. You guys, it's been so awesome talking to you. Angela Sheldon and Francis Collier are Frangela. Come see them October 14th at the Athenaeum. Check out their podcast. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you. Well, I've been working in a coal mine going down.